Firefighting World, you're in for a treat today as we talk with the President and CEO of the Digit Group, Paul Doherty. The Digit Group is a leading smart city design, build, operate, and solutions company headquartered in Memphis, Tennessee. In this, we're going to have a discussion around the behavioral changes to the new normal around coronavirus, life before coronavirus, and life after coronavirus, and draw some parallels to past events like 9/11, and what were some lessons learned in behavioral changes to the path forward. We're going to look at how design is massively impacted around different digital city and people viruses, and ultimately, what are the impacts on frontline first responder workers. We hope you enjoy listening, and take care. Paul, welcome to the Smart Firefighting Podcast. How are you doing today?
Excellent. Thank you, Kevin.
Well, we were all really excited to hear you speak at FDIC and do the whole crowd dive and really get the whole crowd riled up. But considering you're not FDIC, we're going to use this as our next best thing. Please tell us, the audience, a little bit about who you are and some of the work that you do with the Digit Group and Smart Cities.
Excellent. Thank you, Kevin. So we are a boutique real estate development firm that is focused in on providing innovations of all sorts into urban environments and urban living called Smart Cities. We develop a lot of these innovations overseas, which is always very interesting because most of these are American innovations. So we give these innovations a chance to be matured in an environment that is with real users. Now, what does that mean? Well, we have really big issues when it comes to designing either districts of cities or complete cities from scratch. And most of that has to do with three main things. Number one, safety, security, and a measurable increase of quality of life. And as long as we meet those measures, we're talking about things like firefighting, like police work, like education and healthcare. Just so happens that we're right now in the midst of one of humanity's most unbelievable challenges having to do with healthcare of all sorts, both the man-made issues and, of course, the viral issues that we're in the middle of right now in this era of COVID-19. So what we're seeing is that the work that we're doing in real estate development is now colliding with other industries. And it's imperative that these ecosystems of being able to have, the proper conversations and then thought leadership leading forward will help all of us understand what this new normal is going to be so that we can build a trust network with each other. The firefighting community always is a local deal with this local community. And how do you start to regain trust that even going to the supermarket, that the person that's on the other side of the aisle is not contaminated, right, with COVID right now? And how do you start to open up an economy while also providing safety? And I think those conversations between the first responders as frontline essential workers and the general public needs to come out. That's the reason why I think that this podcast becomes an important call to arms in a way for the global community. I think one of the most remarkable things about this particular viral strain that's out there is that it used to be contained within geographic areas over the past 20 years, starting with SARS in Hong Kong and some in China, and then, of course, MERS in the Middle East. And those were, contagions that were limited. This is something like the world's never seen before, at least for over 100 years, and I'm hearing over 1,000 years. So this is a challenge of a lifetime, and Kevin, I just want to say thank you for being able to provide this podcast.
Yeah, no, and I appreciate the opportunity for you being on here. And a lot of people think smart cities, or at least the city design, what does that necessarily have to do with first responders or fire? But as you note, I mean, we're all in buildings right now. We all live in cities, and it's all interconnected to how all different first responders actually respond to different aspects of the scene. And, I think what I'd love to hear from you is sort of not only just city design, but what are some of these behavioral changes that do you see the world adapting to with this new normal of COVID-19? I mean, from what the design or thinking process was even just a year ago to what do you think are some of these design changes that we need to consider moving forward in the next 1, 5, 10 years?
Most modern cities over the past 100 years have been designed in and around the private automobile. The sea change that we're going to see, and that's kind of where this mission vision thing is, or is a touchstone, is that we're turning back now into human-centric design. And it has been our firm's basis of design has always been about the human first, and then all ancillary things would be designed around that, meaning that in order, even pre-automobile, into the world of horse and carriages, it was less expensive to have a street grid to actually house the people that live, work, play, and learn inside of an urban environment. When the automobile came, it became even more imperative to keep that street grid very, very rigid. Well, that's really good for things like, squares and rectangles, if you can look at it like a map. And when you have things like your standpipes and your fire hydrants and all those infrastructure pieces that go underneath the actual street grid, it becomes a really easy way to do city design, because now you know how many lineal feet of pipe that you need, and it's very simple to do. What's changed now, or actually a convergence, this tsunami of change having to do with people rethinking, how do I get from point A to point B? Do I really need my car in an urban environment when I can pick up an Uber? And it's disposable. I don't have to own a car. And then when you start thinking about the other modes of transportation that are transforming from newer types of trains, be it subway or a streetcar type of mobility, to how do you start to look at autonomous vehicles in a different way? So we've been championing for a number of years now with our understanding of autonomous vehicles and what does that really mean? Because there's a big focus on driverless cars as autonomous vehicles, and that's not quite true. The world of cars within the next generation will start the downward curve, flattening the curve as we've been hearing, right? But this is about behaviors where people are realizing that why take on the expense of maintaining your car, putting petrol and gas into your car, and in certain cities, the price of where you park your car on a monthly basis is almost as expensive as your apartment. So people are going, this is a little crazy. And with the advent right now of seeing how you can look at fleet management as public transportation system, we're now seeing the advent of a public transportation system based upon autonomous vehicles. We're also seeing that certain sectors, restaurants, medical labs, those types of things do not need to be physically in one place as a piece of real estate. We're looking at these mobility units being moving real estate, meaning that we now have an opportunity to reimagine what it means to have a house call. People are realizing, why should I go to a doctor's office and wait in a waiting room when there's probably other more sick people than me and I could be catching something? Wouldn't it be a lot easier to actually take a mobile lab and then rethink what it means to have that mobile lab interface with your building? If it's an apartment building, it could be something where the mobile lab needs to almost be like a separate vehicle totally, where you have your doctors and your other health practitioners either for a lab examination or an actual procedure. That is what's being master planned right now in places like China. So moving real estate. Oh, also this idea about going out to dinner. For the foreseeable future, I can't see, just the ridiculousness and the absurdity of being able to be 6 feet apart inside the restaurant when restaurants have to make money on a certain volume of churn. Let's say there's 50 tables. What happens when you do 6 feet apart, even with the person you're going out to dinner with, and you can fit 20? How do you make money? So it sounds good to open up the restaurants, but until we figure out how to trust people and understand what that particular pool of people is going to be trusting each other so that we can, again, step forward into a new normal, we're looking now at the alternatives of having things come to you. Because that's a huge behavior change. It's not going to be 100% everything's going to be mobile. But the idea is we're moving away from this idea of needing a shared workspace. Poor WeWork. The last thing people want to do is go into a shared community office like that. This whole shared economy thing's got to be thought. So what happens with the design because of this mobility means that the mobility functionality of these things changes the shape of roads. So we're going from a street grid, which means that, if you're a firefighter and you're going off to a particular event, you're more or less saying, okay, you know, you make, you know, you go up Broadway and you make a left on 42nd Street. Well, what happens when the streets do not follow a grid? That replacing the buildings for the optimal, for optimal efficiency. It could be that maybe the city that is being redesigned and or being built is near a body of water, let's say a sea or an ocean. There are prevailing winds that happen in the mornings and the afternoons that you could be placing your buildings for climatic reasons and also geography reasons where you can actually start capturing wind. And what would happen if wind then becomes that generator for certain types of energy? Interesting, right? It also becomes a way of cooling. I spent a lot of time on the west coast of Saudi Arabia, right on the Red Sea, in an ancient city called Jeddah. Their old town is designed where it looks like it's haphazard over the centuries that this trading port has been. You know, and there is no glazing, there's no air conditioners, but you feel cool. Why? Well, it's called passive design. They're able to take those winds in the morning, winds in the afternoon off the Red Sea. And what they've done is that they've captured it where you can actually funnel that wind through very, very narrow gaps between buildings. And then suddenly it's into an agora or a market that is wider. Think of how your lungs work. That's exactly how it's designed. How we lost that in the design of urban villages, you know, in the United States, Canada, Australia, which are the kings of pop-up cities over the past 100 years, because we all based it on the automobile. If we really thought about how to cool people naturally, do we really need to put the loads on the power grids and the pollution parts of how you actually cool and heat buildings? So that's the rethought, right, about where you place the buildings. Now think about roads. If you do not need the safety factor of putting at least 2 to 3 feet on either side of a car because, well, humans are not perfect, and we have to build in the fudge factor. That's why the roads are so wide. What also happens with curbs? You know, curbs are meant there to somewhat make sure that if you're falling asleep or you're too close, you bang into the curb, you're not going to do that again, hopefully, right? And also curbs are there for stormwater runoff as well, to get to different culverts and stormwater access so that we can, you know, ease the flooding issues. But what happens when you redesign the roads where there are no curbs, but you're still doing stormwater management? What happens when you do not need to have a street grid? Because you're placing the buildings where they're optimally efficient. And now all of a sudden the spaces between the buildings just become a road or a way for these moving vehicles to move around because they don't need the turning radiuses of traditional automobiles. They can pivot because they have round wheels. And what I mean round are orbital wheels, like, you know, like a ball, which means that you have full ways of rethinking what space requirements do I need. And plus, when you're talking about autonomous vehicles at its optimal maturity, they will coexist with humans. Right now, they're using the wrong technologies, which is why you're hearing about some of these experiments of these self-driving cars killing people. It's the wrong tech. We've rethought what that means. And what we've done, as an example, and this ties right back into first responders and specifically firefighters, we figured out LED lights that are replacing the HID lights in the streetlight systems of any city in the world have a certain type of light stream, a flickering, if you want to think about it like that. And it resides at such a high frequency that you can run internet protocol on top of the light beams at over 5G speeds. Now, this sounds like science fiction, except this is an actual product that's being sold by Verizon right now here in the U.S. So think about this. Our streetlight systems now are the guidance systems for all autonomous vehicles. Why? Because we have throughputs that are at light speed, almost like, you know, this, you know, like what they're doing on Wall Street now with the flash trading and all that stuff, same and similar technology. So that we are in full control of those 12 tons of steel that are running in an urban environment in real time. The other thing it does, and this is where it ties into the firefighting community, is that it provides light speed. It's a public-private network for metropolitan uses. So our first implementation of this is in the city of Nashville, Tennessee. After experimenting overseas with our other projects, the maturity level of what we've been able to witness now becomes an ecosystem. just before all the COVID lockdown happened, there was a big tornado that ran right through downtown Nashville, destroying entire areas. The north part of Nashville, an area called Germantown, which is only, less than half a mile from the state capital, was wiped out, as was East Nashville, which got a lot of national attention before, the virus kind of stole the headlines. And the reason why that's important is because we have a big decision to make as a master planning group. Do we just rebuild to what was, and that is driven a lot by insurance, and in the case of this, also federal money through FEMA? Or is this an opportunity to say, since everything's wiped out down to the foundations, could this be part of weaving in a new type of tapestry into the urban fabric of Nashville? Being able to experiment with these different types of road designs, which means if we're talking about the placement of buildings not being in a man-made grid, how and what do firefighters do on how work gets done? Because you're no longer doing a Cartesian coordinate, going up X amount of feet and then making a left on this amount of feet or making a right-hand turn in order to get to an event. What happens if we create efficiency that you can go perpendicular and get there quicker? Now, all of a sudden, things become interesting because every second that you save could help save a life. So the actual physical design of cities as urban villages where you have clusters of density is really the next wave of how we're designing cities all over the world. It also helps with contagions, either crime, be it digital viruses, and also the natural diseases that are going to occur and occur and occur. We can't hide our heads about this. In the past 20 years, we've had 5 major outbreaks of strains like a COVID-19, and they're only getting stronger and more squirrely. So we know that we're in this age. So are we going to continue to design things with our heads in the sand like an ostrich? No. The idea here is that instead of a street grid, we take a look at how suburban design is put into place. So there's very few instances of suburban design that are pure street grid. Those are usually meant for downtown areas of cities. But what happens is when you design, let's say a brand new community. I was with a Fortune 500 company, a production home builder for too many years. And this is what we did. We subdivided a farm. And what we did was we put in a certain road design to more or less keep the riffraff out. You know, it could be that it's a community where you have a gatehouse. Sometimes that happens, and that's pretty popular, around, the U.S. And other times you don't, but you can actually create it in such a way where you have winding roads, you have cul-de-sacs, you have places that if you're at night and you're a robber, it's going to be more of a pain in the ass to remember how to get the hell out. And that's why you design it like that. Well, what would happen if we looked at downtown urban environments now and reimagined, like Nashville? What would happen if we didn't have the street grid, but we could actually create these beautiful
Paul, are you still there? Pat, are you still there?
Yeah, Paul just muted himself.
Yes, yeah. I don't know how that happened. Bottom line is when you have, the world of Nashville that says, how can we start to reimagine this by placing the buildings where they're optimal, where the roads are the spaces between the buildings that we have full control over because of the streetlight system. Now things get interesting because you can build clusters and be able that if there is a testing mechanism that comes online that people use and you can start to have it at least as anonymous information that feed into the CDC or NIH or other governmental bodies that are tracking what happens if there's an outbreak of the flu in this particular sector, you could shut it down now. This idea of shutting down an entire city when you know it's only in that square block because you have the data to support that, you've now built in circuit breaker mechanisms in the physical design and layout of cities. So this becomes not just a way of limiting crime. It starts to limit the amount of disease spread, potentially. And also this idea that says, well, in order to unlock how we get out of this mess today, with COVID-19. How do you build up the trust network? And what we're doing is using urban design that meets technology, which is really the essence of smart cities, right? And the innovative technologies that we are leveraging right now are based upon QR codes, where if you are tested, either a home kit, be it a swab or a blood test, you can then telemedicine the results, almost like the way that type 2 diabetes people can use a blood test every day to find out what their blood sugar is. And a lot of times you can then teleport that or send it to your healthcare provider. Or there's a lot of systems online. I know Abbott Lab, I use one called Freestyle, that I don't need to prick my finger. It's a surface mounted tab that you use your app, and it actually then reads your blood sugar, and then it goes back into my own personal tracking of how's my blood sugar going. Now, imagine now as we start to track the maturity of these test kits. The first ones are very clumsy. They're very, if they expect people to stick a swab up their nose into the back of their sinus cavity, good luck with that. First of all, I'd be a little nervous having a healthcare professional doing that, let alone do it myself, which is why the focus on these blood kits and watching the maturity of these things is huge. Because as you start to take into account that if you are living in a building, let's say it's an apartment building with 20 other families, wouldn't it be really nice to know that everyone inside of that particular dwelling was green and it's on an app, or you can print it out? Way that we're also thinking this through specifically for Nashville is this idea of having a sticker that goes over your public assistance card or your driver's license, so that it becomes something that if you do test positive, either in your home or when you go out to a restaurant, or maybe you want to go to Walt Disney World, that you know that you're going to get a report that if that you are negative, it generates a QR code for a period of time, 24, 48 hours, 72 hours, whatever the length is, and what people are, and people are going to learn what's acceptable. So that when I scan my QR code, either the static one, that's a little sticker, that will go up to the cloud and securely and say, yes, this person is cleared. Or it's like getting onto an airplane nowadays with the QR code, where you just go over the scanner and you board the plane. It knows who you are. Knows that you have that seat. Now imagine that when you walk into any type of facility, be it your Costco, the next ball game for Major League Baseball, the NBA, next Carnival Cruise Line, that everyone inside of that enclosure is green. You're now building a trust network again. The real interesting thing about this is limiting that to a unique ID. Because, again, in the democracies of the world, especially the Western countries, they're very, very, very cognizant that blood or medical type of information could be used as like a double-edged sword. You're doing the right thing, opening up an economy, everyone's, saying this is cool, urban design, help contain, but at what cost? Because there's a lot of information that could be behind that. In other countries, like specifically China right now, where we have this system in place with QR codes, they call it their green domestic passport, they're actually opening up. And they are limiting the second wave of all of this. So I think we have a lot of things to think about what are our rights to privacy, especially when things become digital. And digital data, again, is a double-edged sword. It's wonderful for a billion things. It could also be used for other reasons that we can't even think of right now, but you can think of science fiction movies when people get control of your data and your information, right? So we're a very, very interesting, fork in the road of private information, meaning public need, and how do we mitigate the risks on top of that? So again, it gets back from the world of design, the physical layout, and how you can contain certain things, both man-made and natural, to the technologies that are going to analyze this movement, and then and then be able to report that, so that we start climbing out of this mistrust of places and other people. Now, one good side effect that could be with these initiatives, and this isn't us talking, this is Google, Apple. We're partnered up with a group called Hype Labs that are doing some remarkable things over in Europe and South America using these types of technologies. Wouldn't it be really interesting that because it knows your place, because of location-aware technologies that are in every one of our phones, that it does not identify you, or if you want to be identified as you, that's fine, but you're giving permission for that. But wouldn't it be really interesting to know that it's a office building in downtown Manhattan that's on fire? The biggest issue is, number one, how do you keep the firefighters safe so that they can protect others, right? That's number one. But number two, wouldn't it be really interesting to know that you have authenticated and accurate data that there's 15 people on floor 10? Now, all of a sudden, you start to give the advantage of data that's communicated in real time to the actual heroes, you know, our firefighting community. So again, there's going to be a lot of this give and take, like, man, that's really, really good. But how do we make sure that that authenticated ID is not placed to a person that then all of a sudden becomes misused? So yeah, Kevin, on top of just trying to climb out, from this natural disaster, we have a lot of things that are on the table right now that have a lot of good, but I think the competition needs to happen to say, well, how do we best mitigate the risk?
Well, a lot in there, and I appreciate everything you said. One of the biggest phrases you said that really speaks to me in thinking about this adjustment, whether you like to believe it or not, from old world to new world, is that do we rebuild to what was, or do we use this as a time to really rethink everything? And you brought up a lot from whether it's the shared economy or the movement towards bringing services to people, or even looking at how do we harness natural geographies to better enhance design. I'd love to hear some of your riff on, looking at what are some parallels that we see from, big events that happened in the past, and then how we use that to rewrite our future. And obviously, some of them might be inconveniences to people because we're just used to what we've always known. But what are maybe some thoughts on how life will no longer go on the status quo, and we are changing to this, a lot of around, obviously, the concept of coronavirus?
Well, that's a good question. Probably the easiest parallel right now would be the immediacy of what happened after 9/11. The shock to at least this part of the world was tremendous. But the shockwaves were really interesting because they actually went to every corner of the earth, right? I mean, the physical stuff was limited to, the East Coast of the U.S., and more specifically, let's say, like New York, Manhattan. But the ripple effects were changing and changed entire societies to where more surveillance and more invasiveness to, quote-unquote, your freedoms was the norm. I remember before the TSA was actually the TSA, but there was a bigger lockdown. I was on a flight about 2 weeks after 9/11 out to a conference. It was one of the first ones to open up in Boston. And that's where I went to school for university, and still have a lot of friends up there. And they know that I'm a big Yankee fan in Boston. So what happened was after I spoke, they gave me a gift. And they gave this beautiful Waterford baseball bat. Right, about maybe, and had engraved on it, the New York Yankees logo, along with, because they won the World Series the year before against the Mets, right, the Subway Series, and they gave it to me. It was such a precious gift. So I did not check bags, and I'm going to Logan Airport, and I get stopped, and they pull out this crystal, heavy crystal club, according to the security professionals there in Boston. And the fact that it had a Yankee insignia on there and I'm in Boston, it's great. This thing's going to get confiscated. Well, we had to work a deal where we actually contacted the captain because they're going to take this thing. It's Waterford. It's special. But they considered it a weapon, right? And I guess 2020, I could kind of guess, all right, maybe it was, but I wasn't going to use it for that. you know, but they we made a deal with the captain that he would hold it in the cockpit. I departed the plane and handed it back to me. I also remember being a few weeks after that on another trip, I think to Kansas City, and they took my nail clippers. Nail clippers. Right? I mean, so everything was all over the board. There was no universal standard, right? And it's still not today. I was in Qatar this past September, and I had to go through security, and I had a cigar clipper, you know, a cutter, and a really nice one, right? Well, the agent there thought it was really nice too and said, cannot use. I'm going, what? with a cutter, a cigar cutter. But I guess he wanted it. So see, even today, you know, there's still a wide range of quality of checking and that type of thing. We always, you know, still hear stories about, you know, some reporters that just want to show up the system. They got in with a knife or a gun or something like that. So again, we're still not there, but the new normal is this. Outside of airports even, in certain downtown areas and certain buildings, you expect to go through a metal detector and an x-ray machine if you're carrying anything. And if it's not there, you're kind of feeling uneasy, right? So it's a really, really interesting behavior change. And that's only, you know, less than 20 years ago. So now we have this new, this upcoming new normal. And I was, and as was mentioned before, what are the freedoms that we're willing to give up for the greater good? And what's going to make me feel good about my family that if I'm leaving my home and I know that I have my green passport that's going to last for 48 hours, isn't that better than what happened the other day at my local Kroger when I'm standing in the aisle in the frozen food section and I hear this loud sneeze? You thought a bomb went off. I watched people run out of the store, scatter all over the place. It was like, oh my God, you know, is this what it's going to be? And the fact that, you know, we're performing, you know, the shelter in place as everyone should. And when we go out, you know, I'm wearing a 3-ply mask and gloves, not to protect me from other people, but God forbid I'm a carrier and I'm asymptomatic. So, I mean, that's the way these things work. It's not that you're going to protect yourself, because that's the selfish attitude. And that's not the way these masks work. This is to keep your stuff inside, right, so that you don't harm other people. So if that's the case, how do we create that trust relationship and how are we going to move forward? And I think this falls into a multi-pronged approach, community by community, where we do need data. Not to say, oh, you know, within 5 square miles of my home, no one's been infected, so I'm going to go run out naked and just, you know, sneeze on everybody. I mean, that's not what that's about. But it's to say, monitor that. And how do we start to build into the curriculum of life the same way that firefighters are so famous and so giving of working with the local school children? To this day, my 10-year-old son loves when the firefighters come, at least twice a year. Right? And from a young age, you know, you're told, you know, not to play with matches. You know, what happens if you catch fire? You know, the tuck roll, you know, drop tuck and roll, all that stuff. And they can recite it. I remember me growing up, I could recite all that stuff. And these people were heroes, right? Because they were just so cool, right? You know, and they had all the cool equipment and, you know, whatnot. How can we parlay that as a firefighting community in order to virally make sure that people have a comfort, right? That there is a trust, and just simple things can help. It doesn't mean that everyone's going to be wearing masks from now on, like what happens over in Asia. But it could be that, you know, just like if there's a severe weather alert, you know, we have sirens that go off here in Memphis, Tennessee, when there's a watch. Right? And it tests every 12 noon on a Saturday to make sure the system works. It's a huge loudspeaker. And guess what? It provides that level of comfort to know that if there's anything that would pop up as an event, we're prepared. What are we going to do now, knowing how a situation like this can shut down the world economy? That can't happen again. We got to be better prepared. So is this something that the leadership, with the you know, with the respect that the firefighting community already has, because they're so woven into the fabric of community, is this an opportunity to lead, to say, listen, the next time that there's a flu outbreak, a viral outbreak, this type of thing, remember this. It just becomes part of the messaging. And I think that that could be a good step forward to provide that level of comfort and security with trusted people. Because right now, I hate the fact that here in the U.S., every single fact becomes a political issue. When looking for leadership, just to say, just cut through that crap. Just let me know what I need to do and I'll do it in order for the greater good. You want me to stay in for 2 weeks? I'll do that. Do you want me to wear gloves and a three-ply mask for a period of time when there's outbreaks? I can do that. And that type of messaging, I think, becomes real. It also means that the idea of three-ply masks are going to become so commonplace in households. It'll be like picking up Bounty tissue, paper towel, Charmin toilet paper, and Kleenex tissues. You're going to have, I don't know, your Walmart, your Amazon, your Kroger, masks. They're just there. Again, not that you have to wear it all the time, but when there's outbreaks, let's think like a community, because that's how we defeat viruses.
Yeah. No, well said. And I would agree that it seems like the dynamic of this, the behavior change of even just wearing the mask, is something that has already become commonplace. And I'm willing, as an American or just a member of my community, to, I don't want to say it's giving up some of my liberties, but I'm willing to make sacrifices and changes to know that I can help play a part in this. You know, and they heard that phrase of where some of our grandfathers, you know, went off to war in Vietnam or in World War II, and, you know, we're asked to sit on our couch in a weird way. And it sounds crazy, but I think that is something where it's the times. And but I'm more interested in looking at, okay, this has happened. What are we going to do moving forward? And you've laid out a lot of really good examples, and I appreciate that. And I kind of want to open it up with sort of two general questions for you that you can answer each one, either one, first or second, but. You know, as it pertains to what's going on now or just in general around some of the amazing work you do with smart city design, what excites you most and what keeps you up at night? And, you know, that is totally open-ended, and it could be around smart city design, it could be coronavirus, it could be some of the new projects you're working on, but interested in your thoughts on those.
Two loaded questions. Thanks, man.
Totally.
So let's start with the things that keeps me up at night, right? One is that there are so many great opportunities to reinvent and reimagine how we function, both from work. Now everyone's rethinking work. Do I need to go to a commercial office building? And of course, companies are thinking that, going, do I really need this much square footage? Because this Zoom thing is awesome. And it seems to work with certain types of work, not all types of work, but it's good enough. And maybe we can build upon that. That's okay. But what happens when we then rethink about life? So work life, family. I tell you what, the next person that says I want to have a staycation, I'm going to smack them upside the head because I'm done with it. Huh. But the idea of family, and this is a double-edged sword. Our contact into the law enforcement community here in the U.S. has shown a tremendous amount of increase of domestic violence during this time. That is something that is exposed because of this event, and the data is staggeringly bad. That makes me sad. We've also seen some amazing things happen now because of schools that are now closed for the rest of the school year across the United States. And what does that mean for homeschooling? What does that mean for those things? So these are all open-ended questions that not so much keep me up at night, but then you get into play. I miss baseball. Sorry, I do. It's spring. It's supposed to be baseball. Even if it's bad baseball, it'd be a game. I try to watch the ESPN horse thing with the NBA stars and had to turn it off. I mean, geez, come on. Horse is supposed to be like, the Harlem Globetrotters doing fantastic things. I'm watching these MVPs, go underneath the basket and say, right hand, I'm going to put it in, and miss. And I'm going, geez, I could do better. So, you know, that's not sports. That doesn't excite me. But what happens with play? You know, I'm watching, you know, my son using Roblox in multi-user environments with his friends, where they're talking to each other on Zoom, but they're playing against other neighborhood kids, and they're bonding, right? And they're continuing their relationship in such a unique way that it's like, wow, you know, what's the outcome of that going to be? Is esports now this, you know, that generation's NFL, you know, as things move forward? And then learn, right? Because it's always, you know, work, live, play, learn. You know, this learning environment, there's people that, have their day still structured, although they're working from home, but more and more people are going into like hobbies, right? You know, painting, this thing, that thing. Online learning is through the roof, right? It's not just about sitting around watching Netflix. So when you take all that into consideration, my fear is that, you know, we try to get back to normal too quick, and that we don't take the time to consider what is happening around us and find the good pieces of those things. The other fear factor I have, of course, is if this goes on too long, what happens in the shambles of a global economy that is no longer global and becomes national? It's great to think, yes, America first, but it's not America only, right? There are still ways of how we all learn to live together. And, you know, our business is a prime example of that. So I'm not crying about, oh, you know, globalism is dead. No, it's not that at all. It's the changed political landscape that you have to then work in, which means that when we're sharing information at events like FDIC with people from all over the world, what I love about the firefighting community is that it isn't about, you know, Thailand's way of working or New Zealand's or the UK's or the US's. It's about finding those similar challenges and looking at similar solutions that really start to then inspire, right? And it raises the human condition to a point where this isn't about, taking your time and learning from your mistakes. It's about communicating with others from around the world to realize that this is a global community. It is not about the Japanese, you know, fire department. It's not about, you know, Moscow's fire department. It's about firefighters, right? And you know, the families that help support the cause, right? And once we get to that humanity level, that's when growth happens. And I'm really, really not afraid, and it's not so much keeps me up at night, but concerned that that momentum that FDIC brings to the community stopped in a way. Not so much stopped for a long period of time, but paused, when this should be the time that we're getting on things like Zoom and other types of communication things to keep that spirit going. And the webinars are great, you know, the online workshops and seeing that thing. But I hope that we get to a trust environment that allows us to freely communicate with each other, because there's nothing like looking at another person in the eye and feeling that energy and know that you're brothers. That's the specialness of, you know, that. What's inspiring me right now the actual designs that we're working on that are not only being validated right now, but the new ones of people being more open. Saying, you know what, it's not like, oh, you know, that's a crazy idea. It's like, well, yeah, okay, what if? And building out the business case, on the private side of things in order to, again, raise the human condition, a more safe, a more secure environment, being able to have people have a happiness factor, be it for themselves, be it for their families, be it for their relationship with faith, with community. And that's inspiring to watch, that this is not a U.S. thing, this is not just a single company thing, but that we're spreading the gospel for all intents and purposes of inspiration will be found all around you. I'm constantly reminded that when I'm designing, let's say I have a brand new put project, which we do in South Africa. So we're taking this open land right now and using human-centric design, we're pulling in cultural anthropologists and understanding the back end notion of what it means for this community that we're designing this urban environment for. And we're taking it from there because there is no cookie cutter on this stuff. And just the other day, I was creating this kind of downtownish center, this particular community. And I thought it was cool. I spent 8 hours on it. It looked really good from an aesthetic architectural standpoint. And, you know, it had autonomous vehicle systems in there. I had alternative energy stuff going. I was really proud of what this thing was. And my 10-year-old son sits in my lap and goes, "What you up to?" And so I explained it and I showed him. And I said, "This is going to be the city of the future." Kind of looked at me, shrugged his shoulders, and went off to go play Roblox. I went, "Hey, doesn't this inspire you?" He goes, "No." And then I took a look at it, Kevin. I went, "You know what? I designed this for me. I didn't design it for him and his generation." So we had a conversation about what he would have changed. And you know what? 80% of it was dead on. So having the conversations, especially when you're building for the future, you've got to be talking to the future. You know, we're not designing it for you and I right now, because in certain cases, we may not be around because of our just natural longevity of life to actually see the full fruition of this thing. But at least we can provide the basics and the disciplines around it so that his generation can take it and take the torch and run with it, so that we can improve the efficiencies of our relationship with the environment, how we have the here and now that we need to improve as well, which is where, again, you know, I look back to, you know, the firefighting community, which is deep in my family. Three of my uncles were the fire chiefs for Donegal County in Ireland, starting off as fire chiefs and, well, working their way up to a little town called Carndonagh. So I was lucky enough to go back to Ireland every summer as I was growing up, and they were my heroes. I mean, I got to sit on fire trucks and listen to the stories that they had and whatnot. And so I get it. You know, I never had the privilege of serving, but I look at the community as one of those foundation pillars of urban living and just living that are so key. And the more that we can help protect them and their families, the more that they're going to be able to protect us. That's the reason why we really want to continue our efforts of innovating for the firefighting community as real estate developers.
Well, thank you, Paul, for sharing all that. And I speak on behalf of the Smart Firefighting community and the entire fire industry that your leadership with Smart City Design and kind of unique thought leadership and all this is extremely valuable and grateful, and we thank you for everything and all for you and all the contributions you and your team do.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Smart Firefighting podcast. If you haven't already, please subscribe to this podcast, leave a comment, and follow us on social media at Smart Firefighting. We would love to know more about what you liked or did not like about this episode. Even more so, we want to know, what do you want to hear more about? Any feedback for future interviews or topics is highly welcomed and encouraged. Thanks again for listening, and we look forward to next time.